Chapter 15. The Opening Salvo. When Doc Long returned from his junket, he moved quickly to fulfill his promise to President Zia and the Freedom Fighters. This time, when the Mercurial chairman asked the CIA to send someone to see him, the deputy director, John McMahon, was determined to avoid triggering the kind of explosion that had followed Chuck Cogan's encounter with Long the previous spring. This time, when he tapped Norm Gardner for the job, McMahon spelled out the mission. At all costs, the case officer must pacify Long. Gardner is one of those CIA men who've actually participated in secret warfare. A former Green Beret, he had signed on with the agency in the 1960s for its campaigns in Vietnam and Laos. But he was also smart, and later would run operations in Africa and eventually become the right hand of Claire George, the agency's director of dirty tricks. It was on the way to this most sensitive of jobs in the clandestine service that Gardner was handed the Long assignment. That year, 1983, the CIA was already in serious trouble with Congress. It had been caught building a Contra army to overthrow the Sandinistas, and the Democratic majority in the House was in full revolt. That's when headquarters selected Gardner to serve as its liaison officer to this troublesome body. At 5'4", Gardner tends to give off a little boy appearance when he puts on his blue suit and Brooks Brothers wingtips. He's incapable of looking mean or dangerous or in any way out of the ordinary. But Gardner is easily underestimated. The first thing he did after receiving his assignment was to take his lunch in a brown paper bag and sit outside the Capitol. He treated the House of Representatives as if it were an intelligence target, and he wanted to know how it worked. For 3 days he prowled the halls, watching, talking, reading, and quickly reached the conclusion that precious few of the 435 representatives mattered. He figured there were only two committees to worry about, the Intelligence Committee, which was supposed to serve as the agency's watchdog, and the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, which meted out its money. Probably no more than 40 representatives and staffers were cleared for agency briefings, and Clarence D. Long was not one of them. But when Long summoned Gardner to his office in September, the CIA's diminutive liaison officer promptly appeared and did his best not to look surprised at the spectacle that began unfolding in front of his eyes. The chairman was expectorating into his spittoon and shouting for his shoes. A nervous aide explained apologetically that the chairman had just sent them off to be repaired. "All right, goddammit, what's the name of that missile?" No one could remember. "Well, goddammit, then bring me my briefcase." With that, the aide scurried off, only to return a minute later to report that the chairman had left the briefcase in his car and the car was also at the repair shop. As Doc Long proceeded to curse his staff, the poker-faced CIA man waited patiently, wondering where this was all heading. Finally, a breathless aide arrived with the briefcase, and Gardner watched with much amazement as Long began pulling out glossy brochures and shouting that this was what he wanted the CIA to buy for the Mujahideen. They were pictures of British blowpipe and Javelin anti-aircraft missiles, and the excited old representative seemed to assume that Gardner would immediately take the brochures out to Langley and put the missiles into the pipeline for the Mujahideen. Gardner was careful to be respectful in discussing the missiles' merits, and before leaving, he assured the chairman that immediate consideration would be given to his most helpful suggestions. He had read about the eccentricities of Congress, but a trip to Doc Long's office was disorienting, like visiting a loony bin. Wilson, however, was thrilled by the chairman's zeal. "Doc was now more ferocious than I was," he says. "It was no longer a question of me going to him for his help. He was telling me to do whatever I had to do to get the guns." Even with Doc Long's support, what Charlie wanted to do should have been technically impossible. To begin with, funding for a covert program had always been the exclusive preserve of the president, and neither he nor the CIA had requested the weapons. In addition, the critical first phase of the legislative session had ended, and while the Appropriations Committee is the ultimate arbiter of funding, it cannot dole out money for any program without a legislative committee having first authorized it. But "them that has the gold makes the rules," said the sign over Doc Long's desk. And since Long was one of the barons of the committee, and Wilson a veteran insider with chits aplenty, they decided to reverse the process and back-end the money through. Wilson had worked his magic with his own subcommittee, and everything seemed on track for him to make his legislative strike, when Doc Long stumbled across an article recounting the plight of a young, blind, orphaned Pakistani girl who had been raped. To the chairman's disgust, the article explained that by Islamic law, rape can be proved only if there are four witnesses. Since there was only one, and since the girl admitted that intercourse had taken place, the Pakistani authorities promptly tried her and threw her in jail for fornication. All bets were now off. Hair swirling, eyes bugging out in fury, the chairman was suddenly calling his newfound friend General Zia a barbaric dictator. "Zia is not going to get a dollar of foreign military aid, period," screeched Long. "I want him to know that I control the bucks." Long dispatched his aide, Jeff Nelson, to inform the Pakistani ambassador that if the girl was not immediately pardoned, put in a home, and cared for, Pakistan would be cut off. For a moment, the plight of this unfortunate teenage girl became the most sensitive issue in U.S.-Pakistan relations. In Wilson's view, Long was just powerful and crazy enough to sabotage the entire Afghan war effort if Zia did not yield. The next day, Zia's ambassador, General Ajaz Azim, appeared in the chairman's office and announced, "His Excellency the President has asked me to communicate to you that the matter about which you communicated with him has been resolved in the exact terms which you requested." Doc stared at the ambassador, shouting back at his aide, "What the hell does that mean?" Very quickly, General Azim assured Long that the girl would be taken care of in a private home for life. The president, he said, wanted the chairman to know that he personally guaranteed this. "As far as I'm concerned," says Nelson, "the blind girl was the key to everything." With Doc back in the fold, Wilson felt dramatically bolder. But before choosing the dollar amount to put into his appropriations request, he summoned Chuck Cogan for a final review of the situation. The Near East Division chief, still smarting from his encounter with Doc Long, was not about to talk to another congressman without a witness. Unfortunately, the man he wanted to accompany him was off at language school, so he was forced to tap the acting chief of the Afghan task force, Gust Avrakatos. There may have been another reason why Gust was chosen to go along with Cogan. John McMahon had not liked having to repair the damage from Cogan's last briefing of a congressman. "So the mission from McMahon," says Avrakatos, "was to prove to Wilson that we weren't sissies, that we were tough guys." Before setting off for the 15-minute drive down to the hill, Avrakatos was familiarized with the sins of Congressman Wilson, a boodling, boozing, indiscriminate skirt chaser who was giving the agency no end of trouble. Unlike Cogan, however, Avrakatos was interested in having a look at this Hunter Thompson of the hill, and unlike his division chief, who numbered kings among his personal friends, Avrakatos prided himself on being tough to intimidate. Avrakatos knew he was going to enjoy himself the moment he passed the threshold of the congressman's office and took note of Charlie's Angels. He liked the Truman and FDR pictures on the walls, the statue of Churchill, the giant painting of George Washington at Valley Forge, the blow-ups of the Mujahideen, the map of the world covering an entire wall. But the congressman struck gold with Avrakatos the moment he began talking to Cogan. "Rays were coming out of him," Gust recalls, "and I could sense that he had an immediate dislike of Chuck. He was the only congressman I ever met who used the word fuck in the first 45 seconds. Wilson began by asking Cogan what the agency had done to come up with a weapon to shoot down the Hind. It was one of those questions designed to put the CIA official on the defensive. The only realistic answer was nothing effective, but to Avrakatos' annoyance it took Cogan some time to concede this simple point. "All right, then, what about the Charlie horse?" Wilson demanded impatiently. Cogan explained that the Mujahideen would never accept an Israeli weapon, and it would jeopardize relations with the Saudis, who were putting up half the money. "Well, if that's your only problem, I can have my Israeli friends put swastikas on the guns," Wilson said. "Cogan looked as if I had farted," Wilson remembers. "He always acted as if people farted right next to him whenever you challenged him." Part of the problem, no doubt, is that Wilson insisted on calling Cogan Mr. Coburn, despite at least one correction. Avrakatos loved watching his division chief squirm. Now Wilson was on a roll, hurling questions at the now defensive Mr. Coburn, who didn't know how to respond to the congressman's accusations that the CIA was sitting on its hands. The congressman said that he and Doc Long were not going to wait any longer. In fact, he was thinking of a special appropriation to buy Oerlikons. What did the agency think about these mule-portable Swiss anti-aircraft guns? Wilson directed this question to Avrakatos, who had been introduced as Kogan's expert on anti-aircraft weapons. "I don't know what the fuck an Erlikon is," Avrakatos responded. Wilson was not impressed. "I thought they hauled him in to be a big dumb target to take my abuse," Charlie says. "I didn't take him seriously at all." There was also the question of Avrakatos's appearance. He had a peasant's physique and those fucking tinted glasses that looked like they came off a shelf at Woolworth's, and very thick shoes. He was a real low-rent-looking guy.